Howdy, y'all.
Amen.
Now, every greeting that I've heard up here has been echoed right back, so why not this morning? Howdy, y'all.
Good.
It's good to be here with you this morning. It's been announced for a couple of weeks that I'd be speaking this morning. I appreciate you showing up anyway. Whit left town, if that tells you anything. He's known me longer than any of the rest of you, but I do appreciate Bill and Whit giving me this opportunity to speak to you this morning, and I hope that what we look at from the Word this morning will be beneficial to us all. So get your Bibles out and follow along with me. First of all, I want to ask you a question. Sports fans, who can tell me who Bill Buckner is? Anybody? Chad, who's Bill Buckner?
Dennis.
I'm sorry.
Yeah, I knew I'd do that. I knew that.
Bill Buckner, I believe, is the first baseman for the Red Sox who blew a crucial ground ball in the World Series.
Right. 86, I think it was. I may be wrong on that. That's who Bill Buckner is. All right, who can tell me who Brett Favre is? Okay, somebody's going to tell me Brett Favre is a three-time NFL MVP, led the Packers to the Super Bowl, greatest quarterback to ever live. Right. Why is that? Bill Buckner made one mistake, right? It was a bad one. It cost the Red Sox the World Series, sure enough. But who do you think throughout their careers made the most boneheaded mistake? Bill Buckner, the first baseman of the Red Sox, or Brett Favre, the quarterback who's thrown the most interceptions in the history of the NFL? It's not even a close call. Brett Favre made far more mistakes in his career than Bill Buckner ever did, and yet we remember Bill Buckner for that one crucial error that he made. He wasn't able to overcome that. He's been labeled from then forward over the years as the guy who blew the World Series for the Red Sox by missing a routine ground ball at first base. So that happens sometimes. People bury the stigma of one mistake throughout the rest of their lives, and they're not able to overcome that, and it's really unfortunate. In the Scripture, we see cases like this, but let me ask you, why don't we call Peter, forsaking Peter? He did that, right? He forsook the Lord. Why don't we remember Peter as forsaking Peter? What about James and John? Why don't we remember them as the sleeping apostles? You know, they did that, right? That was a big mistake that they made. What about persecuting Paul? Why don't we call Paul persecuting Paul? Of these mistakes, was that not maybe the biggest one? These men, we don't remember this way. And yet there's one man from the Scriptures that we remember for one mistake that he made. And I think it's very unfortunate that we do so. I think when we consider this man in a larger context and look at his life from an overall perspective, which we'll do this morning, we see that it's really unfair to do so. So this morning's topic is a bad rap, doubting Thomas. We're not talking about Vanilla Ice when we talk about a bad rap. Although that was that. We're talking about the fact that Doubting Thomas over the centuries has gotten a bad rap because he's been labeled as Doubting Thomas. But when we look at Thomas in the Scriptures, first of all, we're going to notice that Thomas was no different than the other disciples, than the other apostles in his doubting. We're going to look at that, and we're going to prove beyond a shadow of a doubt that Thomas was no different than the rest. He was no worse off, maybe even better than the rest in that respect. We're going to look at that first, and then we're going to look at another account less familiar to us in the life of Thomas, and I think we can learn some great things from Thomas in that respect. So that'll be our task this morning, the next few minutes, to look at Thomas. First of all, to dispel this myth that Thomas deserves this label of Doubting Thomas. First of all, like Thomas, others did not believe at first. And we're going to turn to Mark chapter 16 and look at the account here at the end of Mark primarily to see just how this played out. This is after the resurrection. Let's look at verses 9 through 11 of Mark chapter 16. Now when he arose early on the first day of the week, he appeared first to Mary Magdalene, from whom he had cast out seven demons. She went and told those who had been with him, as they mourned and wept. But when they heard that he was alive and had been seen by her, they would not believe it. So, upon being told that Christ had arisen from the dead, none of them believed it. Notice over in Luke chapter 24, we see, again, a confirmation of this fact. Luke chapter 24, verses 10 and 11. It says, now it was Mary Magdalene and Joanna and Mary the mother of James and the other women with them who told these things to the apostles. But these words seemed to them as an idle tale, and they did not believe them. So we have both Mark and Luke affirming that all of the apostles disbelieved when they were told that Jesus had been raised from the dead. So not only did they not believe Mary and the other women who were there, they didn't believe the two disciples. Go back to Mark chapter 16. Look at verses 12 and 13 now. It says, after these things, he appeared in another form to two of them as they were walking in the country. And they went back and told the rest, but they did not believe them. So again, even after more evidence has been given to them, more witnesses have come and said they've seen the risen Christ, none of the apostles believed. And if there's any doubt in whether it was right or wrong for them to have felt this way, we can look at verse 14 of Mark chapter 16 and see Jesus' response. He said, it says, afterward he appeared to the 11 themselves as they were reclining at table, and he rebuked them for their unbelief and hardness of heart, because they had not believed those who saw him after he had risen. And so Jesus here condemns all of the apostles for their doubting and unbelief. And then over in Luke 24 again, in verse 38, we see the response as Luke records it. So then he said to them, why were you troubled, and why do doubts arise in your heart? So who doubted? Thomas? Yeah. But all the apostles doubted. All of them. Every single one of them doubted the fact that the Lord had arisen. And so certainly, like Thomas, others did not believe at first. And then like Thomas, the others were convinced by evidence. The same thing that convinced Thomas that Jesus had arisen was the very thing that convinced the other disciples. Let's look over in John's account, John chapter 20, and this is where the account of Thomas is given in John chapter 20. But let's look at verse 20. First of all, John chapter 20, it says, when he had said this, he showed them his hands and his side. Then the disciples were glad when they saw the Lord. It was not until the disciples saw the hands and the side, both pierced, of the Lord that they believed. Until then, they would not believe that the Lord had arisen. So what was it, if you remember the story of Thomas, what was it that caused him to believe? The exact same thing. So again, he's no different in that regard. What is a little different is that even then, let's look back over at Luke's account, even then when they had been shown the piercings of Christ, they still couldn't believe what they were seeing. In Luke chapter 24, verses 39 through 41, the Lord says, see my hands and my feet, that it is I myself. Touch me and see. For a spirit does not have flesh and bones, as you see that I have. And when he said this, he showed them his hands and his feet. And while they still disbelieved for joy and were marveling, he said to them, have you anything here to eat? Now it says they disbelieved for joy. I get the idea that it was, even though they had seen it, they couldn't believe what they were seeing. They still had some doubt in their mind, some disbelief. Even though they were happy to see what they were seeing, they had joy about it. Even then, they still couldn't quite believe what they were seeing. So, the other apostles suffered from the same belief that Thomas did. But unlike them, Thomas responded immediately after seeing the same evidence. Look over in John chapter 20 again. In John 20, verses 26 through 28. 8 days later, his disciples were again inside, and Thomas was with them. Although the doors were locked, Jesus came and stood among them and said, peace be with you. Then he said to Thomas, put your finger here and see my hands, and put out your hand and place it in my side. Do not disbelieve, but believe. Thomas answered him, my Lord and my God. When Thomas saw the same evidence, he believed immediately. There was no, I can't believe what I'm seeing with Thomas. He was fully convinced. So if anything, Thomas was more responsive to the evidence than the other apostles. Certainly not less so. So at worst, he was no worse than the others. And at best, you could say that he responded in a more favorable way to the evidence that had been seen. So we've seen here that all of the apostles were doubters, not just Thomas. We can't fairly label Thomas as doubting Thomas when we consider the fact that he was certainly not alone in that, not in any sense of the word. So first of all, I think Thomas has been exonerated. We're not going to call him Doubting Thomas anymore, right? Right, no more Doubting Thomas. Unless you want to prefix every other apostle with that, because they all did the same thing. Now I want to take a look at another account over in John chapter 11 in the life of Thomas that I believe shows him to be perhaps at his finest moment. It's a story that we're probably not nearly as familiar with as the when we think about Thomas. If you ask, you know, what's the story of Thomas, we'd all point to John chapter 20 and talk about the doubting incident. But here in John chapter 11, we have a story where Lazarus is dead. He's sick and he's dying. And Jesus is told about that. And we see the reaction of the disciples when Jesus says he's going back to take care of Lazarus. Let's read John 11, 1 through 7. And we'll notice here that that indeed Jesus decides to return to Judea to heal Lazarus. It says, "Now a certain man was ill, Lazarus of Bethany, the village of Mary and her sister Martha. It was Mary who anointed the Lord with ointment and wiped his feet with her hair, whose brother Lazarus was ill. So the sister sent to him, saying, 'Lord, he whom you love is ill.' But when Jesus heard it, he said, 'This illness does not lead to death. It is for the glory of God, so that the Son of God may be glorified through it.' Now Jesus loved Martha and her sister and Lazarus. So when he heard that Lazarus was ill, he stayed 2 days longer in the place where he was. Then after this, he said to his disciples, 'Let us go to Judea again.'" So we see here the basic story setting up the response of the apostles is that Jesus is told that Lazarus is ill. They ask him to come, in essence, take care of Lazarus. And he says that we're going back to Judea to do that. But then the disciples, in chapter 8, question Jesus' decision to return. They say, in verse 8, the disciples said to him, "Rabbi, the Jews were just now seeking to stone you. And are you going there again?" In essence, are you out of your mind? They're going to kill you if you go back there. They've just run us out of Judea trying to stone you, and you're going to go back there? So they question the judgment of the Lord himself. Then what happens? Jesus rebukes their cowardice here in verses 9 through 10. It says, "Jesus answered, 'Are there not 12 hours in the day? If anyone walks in the day, he does not stumble, because he sees the light of this world. But if anyone walks in the night, he stumbles, but the light is not in him.'" This response is a little bit cryptic to me. It's a little bit hard to understand exactly what he's getting at. But I think Jesus is saying, there's a limited amount of time for me to accomplish the work that God has sent me to do. We're in the midst of this 12-hour day, and there's work yet to be done. And while there's light to do that, we have to be doing this work. We can't fear what the Jews will do to us, because we have work to do. We can't wait till the night to do it. That's not going to work. That's not part of God's plan. So I think that, in essence, is Jesus' response, is that there's work to do, and we can't let anything stop us, the Jews or anything else. And so he rebukes them for the cowardice that they show in their response. And yet, amazingly, they try to talk Jesus out of it again. In verses 11 and 12, it says, "After saying these things, he said to them, 'Our friend Lazarus has fallen asleep, but I go to awaken him.' The disciples said to him, 'Lord, if he's fallen asleep, he'll recover.'" They say, this isn't serious enough of an issue for us to risk our lives going back to Judea. If he's just sleeping, he'll be all right. He doesn't need us to go all the way back there and go through all this trouble of risking our lives by the hands of the Jews. He's going to be okay. So, yet again, they question the judgment of Jesus. They question his decision-making capability. And they try to talk him out of this trip back to Judea. So up to this point, the disciples have all shown themselves to be quite the cowards and quite lacking in faith in the instructions that Jesus has given them. So then, in verses 13 through 15, Jesus reaffirms his resolve to go. It says, now Jesus had spoken of his death, but they thought that he meant taking rest and sleep. Then Jesus told them plainly, Lazarus has died. And for your sake, I'm glad I was not there, so that you may believe, but let us go to him. And so Jesus ends the discussion here. He says, look, here's the deal. He's dead. I'm glad you weren't there because you wouldn't have this opportunity to build your faith by seeing what I'm about to do, raising him from the dead. And so that's Jesus' resolve. He says, but let us go to him. That's how he ends his statement. And I get the idea throughout this context that I picture in my mind, as this conversation is going on, Jesus is gathering whatever things that I get the picture that he's getting ready to go, and all the others are just kind of standing around staring at each other, trying to figure out a way to get out of this. And then at this point, Jesus is done. He's got his stuff. He's walking out the door, and everybody else is just sitting there looking at each other. Let's notice now what Thomas does in response to this. In verse 16, we see here that Thomas sees the resolve of Jesus, and then he speaks up. Of all the apostles, he's the one that speaks up. It says, so Thomas called the twin, said to his fellow disciples, let us also go, that we may die with him. We see the resolve. We see Thomas showing his faith in Jesus, his determination to, no matter what the cost, follow Jesus, even if it means his own life. So Thomas, from his statement, it seems that Thomas fully expects to die with Christ. He says, let us go that we may die with him. But he says, you know what? That's okay. That's okay. We've seen the Jews. We've seen their hatred of Jesus. We've seen their hatred of us for following Jesus. And we fully expect that they're going to kill us. But he says, that's okay. Let's all go and let's die with him. And so he's undeterred in his resolve to follow Christ, and certainly shows a good example. And not only does he say, I don't know about the rest of you, but I'm going. He says, let's all go. Mm-hmm. He knows what's the right thing to do. And he doesn't just decide to do it himself, but he encourages others to do the same thing. He tells all the other apostles, come on, quit standing around. We're going with him. Let's go. And so we see, I think, something really admirable in Thomas here, that he's not just willing to follow Christ, but he's also willing to lead others in doing that. He's willing to tell others, this is the right thing to do, and you need to do it. He's willing to tell them that standing around while Jesus is going to die is not the right thing to do. As followers of Christ, as his disciples, as his apostles, we must stand by his side. Yes. And so I think we see something very admirable in Thomas's response to this situation. So I think we can learn a lot from Thomas. And there are three things that I want to pull out from what we see Thomas doing here in this passage. First of all, we must be willing to die. When you look at Thomas, you see a man who was willing to die for his friend. And what had Jesus said about that? Over in John chapter 15, or I guess it's what Jesus will say. He hasn't said this yet, but we know how Jesus feels about this. John 15 in verse 13, John records that Jesus says, greater love has no man than this, that someone would lay down his life for his friends. Thomas was willing to do that. He was willing to die for Lazarus. He was willing to die for Jesus. He was willing to do that, and he showed himself exemplary in that way. Notice over in Revelation 2, verse 10, what was said to the churches by Christ. He said, whoever loves his brother, no, I'm sorry, chapter 2, verse 10 of the Revelation. I'm in 1 John. Revelation 2, verse 10. He says, do not fear what you're about to suffer. Behold, the devil is about to throw some of you into prison, that you may be tested. For 10 days you will have tribulation. Be faithful unto death, and I will give you the crown of life. Jesus here tells those who are about to suffer, those who could foresee persecution, just like these apostles, he told them, you need to be faithful to the point of dying. And so we see that Christ demands it, that we be willing to die for Him. He tells us that it's a demonstration of our love for another, that we would be willing to die for them. And Thomas was that kind of man. Dying Thomas, we might call him. The fact of the matter is that Thomas had already given his life to Jesus. That's why he was willing to die, I think. If we look over at Mark chapter 10, we see a statement made by Peter that I think demonstrates this fact that should be evident to us, I think. When you look at what the apostles had given up to follow Christ, what did Peter say in Mark chapter 10, verse 28? There he said, "See, we have left everything and followed you." Well, what did Jesus say in response to that? Did he say, "No, you haven't left anything"? No, he doesn't dispute the fact that they had indeed left everything. What he responds with is that, "Oh, you'll be repaid for that." But I think it does show us that these apostles had given up a lot to follow Christ. And I think that's what prepared Thomas to be willing to give up his life, because he had already really, in essence, done that. He had given up his life to follow Christ. And then over in 2 Corinthians 8, we're told that we need to do the same thing. In 2 Corinthians chapter 8, verses 3-5, 2 Corinthians 8, here Paul records, "For they gave according to their means, and I can testify, and beyond their means, of their own accord, begging us earnestly for the favor of taking part in the relief of the saints. And this, not as we expected, but they gave themselves first to the Lord, and then by the will of God to us." We see here regarding the generosity that was shown by those of whom Paul spoke. They were able to do what they did for the Lord because they had first given themselves to the Lord. And I think that's exactly what happened in the case of Thomas. He had already given himself to the Lord. And so then dying for the Lord was nothing to him. That was just part of the package. That was what was expected of him. And he realized that. And he was willing to do that. And so if we first give ourselves to the Lord in deciding to live the way He wants us to, not the way we want to, in doing His will and not our own, then when it comes to the point of needing to sacrifice our life for someone, for the cause of Christ maybe, that's not going to be a big thing to us. And that's hard to fathom for us. The fact that this decision would come and we would say, "Okay, I'm ready." That's hard for us to imagine, because I think we haven't, in a lot of times, gotten to this point where we've turned everything over to Christ, where we've decided, "I'm following the Lord no matter what, and none of this stuff matters." If we can get to this point that Thomas was at, then we'll do well in being ready to sacrifice when it's necessary. Like Thomas, we need to be willing to rebound. Thomas certainly made a mistake. There's no denying that. We're not saying that he was mistake-free. He doubted and shouldn't have. The Lord rebuked him for that. But Thomas was able to rebound from that mistake. Let's look at some of the things that we see Thomas doing going forward. Notice in Acts chapter 1. Acts chapter 1, verses 13 and 14. This is just after the Lord has ascended. It says, "And when they had entered, they went up to the upper room where they were staying, Peter and John, James and Andrew, Philip and Thomas, Bartholomew and Matthew, James the son of Alphaeus and Simon the Zealot, and Judas the son of James. All these were with one accord, were devoting themselves to prayer, together with the women and Mary, the mother of Jesus and his brothers." And so we see here, first of all, after the Lord has ascended, we see Philip too for that matter, they had all failed, and they all are here together waiting on the promise of empowerment. They're waiting on further instruction from the Lord. They're praying. They're together strengthening one another. And so we see that Thomas here has recovered quite nicely from this doubting episode that we're so familiar with. Over in Acts chapter 5, we see further in verses 17 through 21. It says, "But the high priest rose up, and all who were with him, that is, the party of the Sadducees, and filled with jealousy, they arrested the apostles, including Thomas, and put them in the public prison. But during the night, an angel of the Lord opened the prison doors and brought them out and said, "Go and stand in the temple and speak to the people all the words of this life." And when they had heard this, they entered the temple at daybreak and began to teach. So we see here, Thomas, among the other apostles, being imprisoned, being threatened, and yet continuing to teach the gospel of Jesus Christ, despite the dangers that that entailed. So we see Thomas, again, continuing to serve faithfully, even after having made mistakes in the past. And over in chapter 8, we see the first few verses here, 1 through 3. "And Saul approved of his execution." That was Stephen, who was stoned in chapter 7. "And there arose on that day a great persecution against the church in Jerusalem, and they were all scattered throughout the regions of Judea and Samaria, except the apostles, including Thomas. Devout men buried Stephen and made great lamentation over him, but Saul was ravaging the church, and entering house after house, he dragged off men and women and committed them to prison. In the face of this intense persecution at the hands of Saul of Tarsus, Thomas and the other apostles remained in Jerusalem because that's where God wanted them. That's where He wanted them doing the work of spreading the gospel. And although others fled, Thomas stayed right there and continued serving the Lord and doing His will." So we see that even after having made mistakes, Thomas was able to rebound and go on to do great things. Paul talks about this over in Philippians chapter 3, about how we need to do the same thing. In Philippians chapter 3, Paul encourages us to forget the past and press ahead. Philippians 3, 13 through 14. "Brothers, I do not consider that I have made it my own, but one thing I do know, forgetting what lies behind and straining forward for that which lies ahead, I press on toward the goal of the prize of the upward call of God in Christ Jesus." Paul had certainly made mistakes. We talked about persecuting Paul at the beginning. What had Paul done? He had overcome as well. And he says here that he did that by forgetting what lies behind. Put that stuff away. It's not important anymore. We've been forgiven of those mistakes of the past. We can learn from them, certainly. We could try not to repeat them to the best of our ability, but we can't dwell on those. Thomas didn't do that. He didn't live the rest of his life saying, "Man, I can't believe I doubted. Man, what was I thinking?" He didn't do that. He didn't beat himself up over that. He moved forward. He put that behind him. He said, "Man, I'm sure that he had some moment of reflection on that and said, 'I can't believe I did that.'" But then he went on. He moved on from that. He went on to do these great things that we've seen him, along with the other apostles, doing in the book of Acts. So forgetting the past and pressing ahead is what we have to do, just like Thomas did. And like Thomas, we must be willing to lead. Thomas led by example to break group paralysis. Remember over in verse 16 of chapter 11 of John, where Jesus has said, "Let's go to Judea." Again, I get the picture that everyone's just standing around looking at each other. Everybody knows what they're supposed to do, but no one's willing to do anything. You see this, when I say group paralysis, that's what I'm talking about when there's a group of people and everyone knows what needs to be done, but nobody's willing to jump out there and do it. You see, you know, maybe someone's getting beaten and people are looking on and everybody knows that somebody needs to help, but nobody does anything. Everybody's like, you know, "Somebody help," you know, like, "What about you? You know, why not you?" Thomas didn't do that. Thomas said, "Okay, I'm going to step up here. I'm going to be the leader here. I'm going to say what needs to be done, and I'm going to encourage others to do the same thing." So we see great leadership from Thomas over in John chapter 11. With zeal, you can lead this church in great things, just like Thomas led the apostles. Look over at Romans chapter 12. Romans chapter 12, verse 8. Paul here says, well, backing up to verse 6, get the whole sentence here. "Having gifts that differ according to the grace given to us, let us use them. If prophecy, in proportion to our faith. If service, in our serving. The one who teaches, in his teaching. The one who exhorts, in his exhortation. To the one who contributes, in generosity. To the one who leads with zeal, to the one who does acts of mercy with cheerfulness. He, Paul says here that with zeal we can lead in the church. And I don't think Paul's talking here about the elders. I don't think he's talking about the preacher. I don't think he's talking about the deacons. I think he's talking about all of us. There are things that we can do to lead others. Not saying I'm the boss and I get to make all the decisions, but we can lead by example. We can lead by demonstrating what the right thing is to do and then telling others, join me. Join me in that. Let's do that. So when we're thinking about us, when we're looking around and we see that maybe something isn't being done to our satisfaction, we see that there's something that we could perhaps do better, then what should be our response? Should we complain to so-and-so that, man, I can't believe that this is going on? Should that be our response, to just to murmur and complain about those sorts of things? Should we just sit back and do nothing and just grumble to ourselves, always frustrated when we see whatever it is going on or not being done? Or should we rather lead by example and encourage others to do the same thing? That's the way we should act. That's the way Thomas acted. When Thomas saw the other apostles standing around making up excuses for following Jesus, he said, "We'll have none of that. This is what needs to be done. We're going to go with him. We're going to die with him if that's necessary. And let's all do that together. Let's do it together." And so we can do the same thing. We can show others the way by our actions, by demonstrating the right things to do. And sometimes we expect that to be enough. We think, well, I'm setting a good example. That's good enough. I think we need to follow the example of Thomas and tell others, hey, you need to be doing the same thing. And we need to do that in love, of course. But we don't need to assume that others are going to see what we're doing and pick that up and understand it and then do it themselves. We need to help them along sometimes. We need to say, you know, I noticed that you do this. You might have noticed that I do this. That's different. Well, here's why I do this. And encourage them to do the same thing. You see, we can do that sort of thing. And that's leading. That's what Thomas did. And that's what we can learn from him and do the same thing. So, are you ready to give your life? Thomas was. Are you ready to bounce back from mistakes? Thomas was. And are you ready to step up and lead? Thomas was. He was ready to do those things. And so we see in the account that we considered this morning a great example in the man Thomas. No longer doubting Thomas. But dying Thomas. Rebounding Thomas. Leading Thomas. He was a great man. He was a great apostle of the Lord Jesus, and one from whom I think we can learn a lot. So let's do that. Let's consider him this morning. Have you given your life to Jesus? If you haven't, then we can help you with that this morning. If you need to be baptized into Christ, we'd be glad to help you with that. Let us know. If you've done that and you've fallen and need to bounce back, we can help you with that too. If there's some way that we can encourage you in your struggle against sin, we'd be glad to help you with that. If you're wanting to step up and lead, do it. You don't need our help. Just do it. If there's something that you need to discuss with the elders, that's fine. Do that. I'm sure Bill and Will will be glad to talk to you about something you're wanting to start, something you're wanting us to start doing. But if it's a matter of just setting a good example for others and encouraging them to do it, just do it. But anyway, this morning, if there's anything that we can do to help you respond to the gospel of Christ, and let us know by having a seat on the front as we stand together and sing.